This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk, and that's Christopher Reich. You hear in the background. He's here to talk about his new book, The Prince of Risk, and it's just out from Doubleday and all your bookstores now, and it's really good because I'm reading it now. Hello.
Good morning, David. Hi.
Hi. Is it nice to talk to you? It's funny because when we started the interview, I don't usually have the author talk before I introduce them, so it's good to have you on the show.
It's great to be here. Talking to you today from sunny San Diego County.
Right. It's 7 o'clock in the morning, no less. So
exactly.
Are you working on a new book?
I am just finishing the last 40 pages of my next book, which is called Invasion of Privacy.
That sounds interesting.
It is. It's very much from. It was inspired first by the that Rupert Murdoch phone hacking scandal in England. It's still going on. But I took that and kind of ran with it and kind of examined, you know, all our dependence on these digital devices we use so much, our phones, our computers, our televisions, everything, and what would happen if some really bad people started using those against us. So it's a very fun story about a mother, the wife of an FBI agent, who discovers that their family is being looked into and spied on by no less than the evil kind of head of an imaginary Google or think of a very bad Mark Zuckerberg.
Right. Now, are there different characters in each one of your books?
I have written one series for three books, the Rules series, Rules of Deception, Rules of Vengeance, and Rules of Betrayal. And now I'm back to writing standalone books. Prince was the first kind of back in the financial area, which is where I came from. My first few books were financial thrillers. And Invasion of Privacy is also standalone with new characters, but more kind of in the Michael Crichton, you know, what-if mode, a little bit science, a little bit of technology, a little bit of espionage.
You know, Michael Crichton, boy, I miss him. Oh, boy, what a titan.
Yeah, right.
What a titan he was. Although, I mean, the last few books were not up to what I considered, what I liked about Michael Crichton, but I'm not even, the one with the monkeys just completely threw me off.
I think they wrote a few after he died based on his notes that he actually didn't write himself. So that could be the reason.
I don't know. Sometimes I wish they wouldn't do that because it doesn't have the feel of the same Michael Crichton that I know. I mean, look, you think of Jurassic Park and all those other ones, and oh, God, they were so wonderful.
They were from the very beginning. The Andromeda Strain, you know, Rising Sun, Disclosure, Jurassic Park, all those books were tremendous. And he wrote a period book, The Great Train Robbery, which is one of my favorites of his, that took place in the 1850s. So, and actually, he ended up directing that motion picture as well. So he was truly a genius and kind of a man of many skills.
Right. Now, with you, we get about a book every year, don't we? You do about a book a year now, don't you?
I wish I could say. I try to do a book a year. This last one, there's been actually 3 years in between my Rules of Betrayal and...
Oh, has it been that long?
It's been way too long. I got caught up writing the screenplay for my first book, Numbered Account, working with some producers in Hollywood to get that made, and that distracted me. It's still in progress, but that distracted me a lot from spending the proper time on finishing Prince of Risk.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
So some business came in, where my book was originally, Prince was supposed to come out in May. And then they decided, Doubleday, that they would publish Dan Brown's new book, Inferno, on the same day. So we decided to let them have that publication date, and we moved me back to December.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very cool. Do you know a lot about money?
I have an MBA from the University of Texas, and my first career really was as an investment banker, working... when I came out of UT, I went to go work in Zurich, Switzerland, for the Union Bank of Switzerland, and that's where I kind of drew my knowledge for my first novel, Numbered Account. So I worked in Europe for 8 years, first at the bank, then doing some corporate finance, and then I started a watch company and ran that for 5 years in a small little town called Neuchâtel, in the French part of Switzerland, and loved it.
Wow! So you had you've had an interesting life.
Yeah, I didn't start, didn't come to writing until I was 34, 35. In fact, I never wrote stories or anything, and didn't have really an inkling that I wanted to do this as a career until, you know, 5 years into running this watch company, and I started coming to loggerheads with the people, the financial people behind it, and thought, you know, I want to do something else for a living. And I know I'm a good writer just from my business correspondence and stuff like that. And I'm a big reader. I sure love to read. So I said, well, I think I can do this. I think I could write thrillers.
And you've been very successful at it. I mean, very successful at it.
I got lucky. It's the one thing in my life I can do fairly well, and I'm glad, you know, I'm blessed to be able to make a living at it. So it's fun.
I mean, it's also got to be a lot of work. I mean, to write a novel is there's lots. I mean, there's a lot of details in this Prince of Risk book.
This one took, yeah. First of all, writing is very, very hard work. And, you know, when people ask me how you do it, you know, Mark Twain had the best rule. He goes, first rule of writing, apply back of pants to seat of chair, or seat of pants to back of chair. In other words, sit your butt down and just work. And I knew it would just take hours and hours. You can't, like, shy away from it. You have to know when you walk into a room alone, you're going to be sitting there for, you know, 5 to 7 to 8 hours that day just working on a story inside your own head. So if you're not really comfortable being alone, it's probably not the right profession for you.
Exactly. And it's, you know, it's a very sedentary life, too. I mean, you're sitting down a lot. You're not getting a lot of exercise, except with your hands maybe a little bit.
Exactly. Well, you sit down, but you know what I do, and I think a lot of authors do, I get up every probably 30 minutes and walk around, and or I'll get up and do push-ups, or, you know, I have a pull-up bar in my room just to be, I love exercising. If my mind isn't feeling good, you know, my body's not going to be feeling good, or vice versa. So I like to, you know, I can't just sit there for that long, or else, you know, I'd weigh 400 pounds.
you've sold a lot of books. I mean, a lot of books.
I have.
Do you think it's all about the time that you write? I mean, when you got started, I mean, well, nowadays, I mean, the publishing is up in the air now. Everything's e-readers and stuff, and I don't know how it compares to before, but it seems like before, I mean, more people were actually reading books. Now today, they're reading their e-readers.
Well, you know, I don't care how they're reading, if it's a paperback, hardback, or e-reader. It's, you know, I like people to read my work. What you did used to see, though, and what is a lot more people reading paperbacks, and that's the portion of the publishing industry that's just been decimated, been gutted. I think paperback sales are down 50% from 10 years ago. So, you know, a writer would used to go and sell, you know, 100,000 hardbacks and then 500,000 paperbacks a year later of the same title. And now they'll sell, you know, maybe 100,000 hardbacks in, you know, 200,000 paperbacks. And then, of course, there's some e-readers built in. But, yeah, it's a tough business these days. You know, people have so many other choices with what to do with their free time other than read a book. You know, you could go look on the train of people coming to Manhattan. And 10 years ago, when I wrote Numbered Account and was coming in and doing research and stuff, there would always be, almost everybody's reading a paperback in the morning when they're coming into the city. Now, hardly anybody is. Maybe they're reading a paperback on their Kindle or their Nook or their iPad, but most of them are doing email, working, playing video games, you know, Angry Birds, whatever, Fruit Crush or whatever, Candy Crush. All that stuff.
Candy Crush.
Yeah.
I got addicted to that thing for a while. You know, it's very easy to get addicted to it. I mean, it's very, I don't know, it's sort of like cathartic almost. I don't even know why. To play.
I haven't played it. I know my daughter is always playing it on her phone, that's for sure.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those, it's just a challenge, I guess. I guess that's what it is, and that's why it's so interesting. But you, I mean, your challenge is writing. Your challenge is making up characters and situations and something that's going to interest the reader. Because if the reader's not interested, they're going to move on to the next thing.
Oh, that's for sure. And that was the challenge when I came to write The Prince of Risk. You know, I'd written these three espionage novels, which I just loved writing because my research involved literally just traveling around the world and meeting with different police agencies in Switzerland and Germany and figuring out these stories and working with some of my friends in the Secret Service. And then I decided to go back to writing financial thrillers, which is The Prince of Risk is... It's a story. It's set on Wall Street. It's about a hedge fund mogul named Bobby Astor. And it opens up with his father, who's the head of the New York Stock Exchange, is called a midnight meeting at the head of the Federal Reserve office building, the Eccles Building in D.C., with the Secretary of the Treasury and head of the Federal Reserve himself to discuss a very serious threat to the United States economy. They decide to take this information they have to the president. They don't make it there. They, in a very terrifying attack, their car is destroyed and they're killed. But the chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, Edward Astor, is able to leave a one-word clue to his son before he dies. And so his son gets this clue and sets off just a single word, the word Palantir. And he sets off to discover what this was and why would his father, with whom he had not spoken in 8 years, kind of reach out his last moments in life to contact him. So that's just the story opens up there. So it takes place on Wall Street, in London, in Shanghai, and really just rockets around the world as we discover this terrifying conspiracy that really has as its goal the destruction of the United States economy.
For some reason, I find I'm annoyed by Bobby. He's kind of an annoying guy. Even I mean, he's very, very smart and obviously very rich, but I don't know. Is he supposed to, I mean, am I supposed to
he
feel...
He gets better. Don't worry. He starts off a bit arrogant, I think is the word, and a little bit full of himself, which, of course, accurately reflects most of these hedge fund guys. They're pretty smart. In fact, they're very smart. They're very hardworking, and they've succeeded because they're usually right, and they're used to being right, and they like being right. Bobby quickly finds out that he's not right about a lot of things. And the fun part of the book is he does start off as this kind of brash, loudmouth, you know, Wall Street billionaire with a lot of swagger. And by the end of the book, he's changed. He's kind of, found out who he really is through a lot of pain and a lot of kind of hardship. And he emerges at the end a better person, I think far more likable than he was at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, he's got everything he could possibly want in life. I mean, there's nothing except for a woman. But he had that and let that go. But, I mean, he doesn't want for anything. So you wonder, being an everyday guy like I am, I wonder, what would that feel like to have everything you could possibly want, be able to enjoy?
I think it would feel pretty damn good.
Yeah, exactly. And
I mean, it would feel pretty darn good. There's a funny scene at the beginning of the book where from his point of view, he's coming back into the city from his giant estate in the Hamptons, and he's complaining about all the traffic coming back in. Then you realize he's not driving. He's actually complaining about the helicopter traffic because he's in a traffic jam trying to land at the South Street seaport in New York. And so he's an accomplished guy, and he flies his own helicopters. The question is, in the book, will he still have all his money and have enough to have a helicopter at the end of the book? Because he kind of has to put that all up in the air, to solve this conspiracy. He has to put his entire fortune at risk.
You wonder, a guy like this, does he ever sleep? These people ever sleep? They worry constantly about their money and are they going to lose it? I mean, and you wonder, does he ever get any sleep? Does he ever have a restful night?
a lot of these traders actually sleep with phone under their pillow. In case they get woken up, they don't have to wake up their wife. They can hear a buzz, and they just quickly, take the phone into the bathroom. So I think they learn how to sleep. I think a lot of these hedge fund people, they like the risk, and that's what adds a little spice to their life, a little edge that makes them come back and want to sit in an office, 8-10 hours a day staring at screens and coming up with ideas to make money. So risk is what drives these people.
Just like race car drivers, when they get in that car, they never know if they're going to get out.
Yeah, that's like a race car driver, but without the risk of slamming into a wall at 200 miles an hour.
And you just wonder what goes through people's head. Why would somebody do something like that? Why would somebody put a tightrope over the Grand Canyon or walk across the Grand Canyon like somebody has done? It's just what goes through people's minds. I mean, it's all about. I guess like you said, all about the risk. All about something could happen, and that's why we do it.
That's what, David. That's one of the fun things about writing books, is getting into the heads of your characters, who, of course, are quite different than you are. I mean, I'm a father of two. I have two daughters. I live in North San Diego County. And here I'm writing a book about a billionaire in Manhattan who has a jet, and his wife is FBI agent, and really learning about what makes other people tick. For the Prince of Risk, I visited New York, the New York FBI office, their counterterror bureau, on three separate occasions, and got to know the people in that bureau, in that office, very well. And it was eye-opening to see, you know, what makes these people, why did they choose the career in the FBI? You know, a lot of them are very bright. A lot of them could easily be working at Goldman Sachs and pulling down $5 million a year. But they've chosen to dedicate themselves to their country and to work very hard, you know, to keep us safe. And I was so impressed with them. They were really crackerjack individuals. And I hope I've conveyed that in this book. Bobby Astor's wife, Alex Sforza, her name is a really a no-nonsense FBI agent who runs the Counterterror Bureau based on one of the women I met, based very closely on one of the women I met in that office, who just knocked my socks off. A very attractive, extremely smart, well-spoken, a woman who was just really dedicated to her job. And boy, I'll tell you, I wouldn't want to be on the other side of an investigation if she was looking into me, because I would be, you know, she wins. She does not lose.
Yeah, she's a very interesting character. I'm kind of hoping you put her in another book, too.
Well, thank you. That's, you know, I've had a lot of people say that she would be good for a TV series. I actually have a lot of interest for these two characters from Hollywood already. So I don't know if it's going to be a motion picture or a TV series, so it's actually going to be my choice.
Well, I wanted to ask, the book, you said you're working on the screenplay for Number to Count. Do you know who's going to be in the movie yet?
Well, you know, it's a very long process, and we got to the stage where we had a fantastic director attached named Oscar Axelson, who was actually from Iceland, and he and I worked on the script for 9 months getting it all ready, and then he had to pull out of the project for personal reasons. And so now we're kind of at a standstill until we get another director attached. But we had been looking at Jake Gyllenhaal, the star. He'd expressed interest in his agency, William Morris Endeavor. So that's someone, you know, we need a great-looking, smart 30-something-year-old to play the lead.
No, that'd be great. I'd love to see that. That's the problem with movies nowadays. I mean, they say they're going to make them, and then sometimes you get excited, and then all of a sudden something will happen, like you said, and nothing. I mean, it's a slow process. Like, and you just never know what's going to happen next.
It's a very slow process, very iffy process, especially because this would be an independent picture, just a $20, $25 million picture. You know, definitely not coming out of the studio system. And you just look at, like, for example, that movie, The Dallas Buyers Club, which is doing quite well with Matthew McConaughey. They had that script going around for 8 to 10 years, and it finally got made. So, you know, you just have to, Hollywood is about persistence, and you never, never give up.
Right. He just won a Golden Globe last night, too, Jared Leto.
Oh, yeah.
And what an interesting man. I mean, I kept thinking, I wish I could listen to him all night instead of these other blowhards.
Yeah.
I mean, as much as I love Hollywood, it's a lot of glitter and sometimes not much underneath. It's
like, exactly.
You just never know. But writing for you, is writing for you cathartic?
It's cathartic when you finish a book. It's a lot of hard work, and, you know, it's 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration, like Thomas Edison said, and that's really true. So, you know, it's an incredible feeling after working on a book for a full year to write the end, and it's done. And that is extremely emotional. That is, I mean, I cry every time when I finish. I totally, not break down, but I have a big gasp, and, you know, hopefully, because most books I try to be a bit emotional, and, you know, you should be feeling something yourself as a reader, that you've come through some perilous situations with your characters. So, in that sense, it is cathartic.
I look at your picture on the book, and you're very serious in the picture. Now, online, you got a big, huge smile. I'm thinking, well, this guy's serious about his work.
That's when you're a thriller author, they want you to look serious, so you're like not allowed to smile. But which is funny, when I go give speaking engagements and I speak frequently to people, they go, Chris, you're quite funny. You know, you tell some funny jokes and you have some great stories. You know, why aren't you writing, you know, more comedic books? I don't know why. I'm just good at writing thrillers, and so once you start, you can't really change what you're doing. So
unless you're James Patterson.
James Patterson is so prolific. He writes all kinds of books, love stories, kids' books. You know, his Alex Cross books, he's great.
He's even wrote science fiction books. I mean, man, 12-year-old kids that can fly, you know, come on now. I mean,
that's the Maximum Ride series. He's great. He's so good for reading. He really brings a lot of people into bookstores that don't just buy his books, but buy other books. And so he's such a great proponent for reading. In fact, It was James Patterson that actually discovered me. When I was beginning my career, I'd written this first book numbered account and was able, through a family friend, to get the first 100 pages into Jim Patterson's hands. Or as we call him at my house, St. James.
Right.
And he read the book, he read those pages and said, called me on the phone and said, "Chris, I read these. You're a pretty good writer. I'm gonna break my personal rule of long standing and recommend that my agent represent you." And so I am probably one of the very, very few authors that never wrote a query letter for an agent, that just got an agent the first time around, with the help of now the world's biggest selling author, James Patterson.
That's amazing. He must have really loved that book.
He was really nice of him, that's for sure. So he set me on my way, and I will be forever grateful.
Now, do you keep in touch with him?
No, not anymore. I did for a while, but he got pretty darn famous, and he's pretty darn busy. So I have noticed, I have seen a couple pictures of him where he has a couple of my books on his shelf behind him, and that's gratifying enough. That's enough. I'm sure he has better things to do than to talk to another writer.
Can't you just picture him with a whole wall full of ideas, like all over, all around him? Like, what do I do next? What's the next book? Ideas. You think about ideas. It's easy to come up with an idea, but to actually write the story is the difficult part. I mean, it's gotta make some kind of sense. It's gotta grip the author, or grip the reader, is what I'm saying. And it's really gotta make. When I read a book, I want to get involved in. I want to feel like the story is really happening. All around me.
That's the challenge for the writer, is to grip the reader in the first 10 pages and keep them on the edge of his seat for the next 400 pages. And that's the task of a thriller writer. And it takes a lot of practice. It takes a lot of practice.
And when you think about when you think about TV shows, a lot of them, you watch them, you're like, oh, this reminds me of another. But you can't do that when you're reading a book. You don't want to be reminded of another book. You want to feel like every author is different. Every author has a different voice. And this is how I feel. I don't want authors to seem like other authors. I want that own. That's why I don't like co-authors. I think, well, who really wrote this book? And I don't want to feel that way. I want to feel like the author is writing the book, and nobody else.
Right. Yes. Indeed. That's why you go. For example, like I love Nelson DeMille, and every year when a Nelson DeMille book comes out, I know what I'm going to get. I know I'm going to love it. And I love his, wisecracking detectives, and I love his stories. Always extremely well written, And I love the Alex Cross series that Jim Patterson writes himself. I love that character. The mystery is almost secondary. They're always exciting, but the character is so fun to be with in his family. You just want to spend time with them, And so, it's hard. John le Carré, the British spy novelist, has always been one of my favorite writers, and it's a thrill when one of his books comes out every 2 or 3 years. It's really something. I put everything else aside and grab that book and say, now I'm going to get to read, spend time with this author. It's special.
Right. Do you get a lot of time to read nowadays?
Well, I do. I have time to read. I try to read every night before I go to bed. Unfortunately, my books do require quite a bit of research, so I'm often sitting there reading about what I'll be writing about the next day. So I read a lot of magazines, and I'm tearing things out and downloading a lot of stuff from the internet. So I know what I'm talking about, and so much of my books are fashioned by real life events and facts. So I need to be on top of that.
Now, you grew up in Tokyo, is that right?
I was born in Tokyo.
You were born
in Tokyo. Lived there until I was 5, and then I grew up. Really, what I can remember is in Southern California, in Los Angeles, West Los Angeles.
So, do you know any Japanese?
I'm in UCLA. Konnichiwa. That's about it. No. I did not say. Back in the day, I was pretty much raised for those first 3 years by a bunch of maids. I was born in 1961, and then Tokyo was still very much recovering from the Second World War. And my dad, who was starting a travel business on a very modest salary, was still able to employ a kitchen maid, a chauffeur, and a housemaid. And so I was pretty much raised by these Japanese wonderful, wonderful people. And I think my parents say that I spoke what they call baby Japanese before I spoke English. But that's helped me later on in life, because now I speak French and German, French, pretty much like English and German pretty well. But, you know, it's very helpful to learn a language at an early age. And that kind of programs your or wires your brain to be able to learn other languages later.
So tell me nowadays, when you actually write, how early do you get up in the morning to write?
Earlier the better. But, you know, I apply the same kind of work ethic that I learned as an investment banker, which is work all day long. So I try to get there by 7:15, you know, work till 5 every day. And you know, I don't really ever cop out. I don't take afternoons off or very rarely go play golf or something like that. I do leave my work a couple days a week to pick up my kids from school.
Mm-hmm.
I like to be in their lives as much as possible. And, yeah, but you have to, you know, everybody could write one book. They say, you know, everybody has one book. And then the hard part is writing books, you know, year in, year out. And you just have to have discipline to sit there and sit down at your desk and get the work done because, you know, the muse does not just land on your shoulder and inspire you. The muse lands on your shoulder after 4 hours of slogging along trying to write 3 pages.
Right.
Then all of a sudden you go, oh, there it comes. And all of a sudden you've written 5 more pages in an hour. But it doesn't come unless you're sitting down working. That is my advice to writers. You have to write. My agent said, he goes, Chris, you know, when there's a problem, I said to my agent, Richard Pine, I said, Richard, I can't figure this out. It's not working. He goes, Chris, calm down. Just sit down and write. It will come to you. And if, you know, sometimes you make mistakes in books. People don't see, you know, the process of writing. They don't see the author write 25 pages and then all of a sudden tear them up and says, oh, that doesn't make sense. They only see the finished product, which, of course, is polished and everything is should be, you know, humming like a or running like a well-made Swiss watch. But, you know, they say easy reading means hard writing. That's what Elmore Leonard said, and it's true.
Interesting. Yeah, you think it would be the other way around, but it isn't. I mean, it's hard to write a book that's easy to read.
It's very hard to write a book. And when I say easy to read, I mean a book that makes sense, that, you know, your characters surprise you, but the characters, you know, these thrillers like I write, they're very, to an extent, formulaic. You know, certain things have to happen at certain points for the reader to be satisfied to want to buy the book again. So the secret is to follow that formula, but keep the story original and new, so people think, oh, you know, they know that the formula is kind of in there, but they're not really spotting it. They're just enjoying the book too much.
And that's what happened with Gone Girl. I remember when I first read Gone Girl, you really just get into that book. I mean, it's like you just delve into it, and you're just totally fascinated by the psychology of it all. I mean, the psychology of the book. And I see they're making a movie of it now with Ben Affleck. But, you know, it's like, that's the book that I want to read every time I read. I mean, that's the book. I want to find a book just like that. And, you know, you just never know when you open up a book what it's going to be, what the experience is going to be like. Sometimes it's too descriptive. You know, sometimes you're not interested in the story or the subject matter, you know, or maybe it's too sensitive for you. Maybe it's about child endangerment. You know, there's all kinds of interesting books nowadays. You just never know what you're getting into unless you know the author. Then you know what you're getting. I mean, like Stephen King, you always know what his are going to be like, but
right.
Because he has a certain way he writes. But every book is different. Now, with you, we know we're going to talk about money a lot of times. We know what, but this it's interesting because you have a spiral in the front of your book here. It sort of reminds me of that show, The Time Tunnel. Remember that show from the?
I do remember The Time Tunnel, and that's exactly, David, what I said. I go, it's like The Time Tunnel. I love that. I love that show. That was a fun show. It's funny, that cover originally was a spider web, like the guy's walking a tightrope over a web. And then we decided to change it to this kind of vortex. It's not really a time tunnel, it's kind of like a little same vortex of danger below him. I love the cover. Great, beautiful, striking cover that will definitely make people come and take a look at the book.
Exactly. And of course, The Time Tunnel, what a great show that was, like you said. And it's just, you know, it's amazing they haven't remade it in some way. Maybe eventually they will. I mean, instead they're making a movie out of Gilligan's Island now, I hear.
Oh, my goodness, that's too funny.
But it's like, yeah, you never know.
Right.
You never know what's going to be successful anymore. I mean, you think you know, and then something will come out, and you'll say, oh, well, everybody will go see that, and then nobody goes to see it. You know, or a book comes out, and you say, this is a great book, and nobody reads it. You know, but it's such a touch-and-go thing nowadays. You just never know.
You never know. I mean, speaking of movies, that movie that I love that just came out this fall called Rush, about the race car drivers James Hunt and Niki Lauda, directed by Ron Howard, starring Chris Hemsworth, you know, one of the most handsome actors, big star, or bigger star, getting big, that was such a tremendous movie, and it wasn't a success. And how could a movie that's that good, that is, does not have one dull moment in it, and I think, I don't know how that movie, you know, everyone didn't want to go see that movie and laugh and be thrilled, but it didn't. So, you know, the public is fickle, and sometimes they don't know what's good, and they ignore what's good and go to what the lousy stuff, you know. Yeah. They think they know it, though.
So. Well, how do you make your book so good, time after time after time? I mean, how do you do it? I mean, what's this? Not that I wanted you to give me.
Like I said, I try to write books that I like to read, and so I have a high. I think my books do work, and I think they are pretty exciting on the whole. And I hold myself to a high standard, and you know, sometimes I don't write a book a year because I can't, and I can't think of something that good. You know, so.
Well, if it's not going to be interesting, why write it?
Yeah, exactly. And I just can't crank them out. And you see, even the best writers, you know, I don't want to name names, that put books out, you know, every year, even less, they hit and miss. Some of them are fantastic. Some of them are not bad, but some of them are less so, you know. And it's because it's very, very hard, if not impossible, to write a great book every single year, you know. Now, I think Prince of Risk turned out pretty good, and it's gotten some really, really great reviews, and the people I speak with seem to have really enjoyed it. But it's that was a super hard book to write because it's about half the story is about this hedge fund operator who has the biggest bet of his career on the Chinese yuan, thinking the Chinese currency is going to depreciate. He's bet $2 billion on that, you know, and at the same time he's investigating his father's murder. And the other half of the story is his ex-wife is looking into the appearance of what seems to be a cell of highly trained mercenaries who are gathering in the New York area to plan some type of attack. And, of course, these things are all interrelated, but this book was, without doubt, the hardest book I've ever written to make these two stories come together and really make sense and to feed off of each other. So you're switching back and forth in each chapter. You're advancing in the tale of each of your heroes. And, this book is interesting because it's taking people into places they've never been before, okay? How many people know what the FBI CT-26 is? That's their counterterrorism force number 26 that evaluates all the threats that are made against the United States. How do you know? You know, you don't know about that. So when you're reading it, you're like, this is really interesting. I didn't know this is how the FBI, works. Or how do you know about how hedge funds operate, how they borrow money, and big sums of money, and it's really interesting. At least if you could make it interesting, you could write it interestingly. So I think that's why people come to my books, is they're learning something, and it's really exciting at the same time.
And I think the fact that your chapters are relatively short, it just makes it even more interesting. I mean, when you're reading a book and the chapter seems to go on and on and on and on, and you're trying to... The chapters are very short, and I think that makes it more interesting. I think it builds the tension. You're like, oh, what's going to happen in this chapter?
Yeah, kind of chapter, thing. You advance the story a little bit, and you try to end each chapter with a bit of a cliffhanger. My chapters, I guess, about when I'm writing them on my word processor, about like 6-7 pages each. So each chapter is around 2,000 to 3,000 words, okay? And then maybe less than that, actually, because I have about 80 chapters, so... Yeah, so they are relatively short, and that's how you break up the story into manageable bites, for the reader. And, people like to come home and read, and they get in bed at night, and they want to, read a little bit, maybe not too much, but when they read, they want the story to advance a bit, so they take a big step forward each time they pick up the book.
Well, the problem,
that's why you write with four chapters.
Right, and the problem with Prince of Risk, it's so interesting, it's hard. I mean, I don't think I could just read two chapters at night. I'd end up reading half the book, which is what I did the other night. And it's like, you can't stop reading. You have to know what's going to happen next. Once you get into the story, you want the story to continue. I mean, I like to read every day, and it's hard because sometimes you forget what's happened before. So you have to, in order to keep that flow going, you have to read a lot of pages. I mean, that's how I get. That's the experience I have. Now everybody's different, obviously. Some people can read two pages every night and be happy with that. No, that doesn't work for me.
There's nothing better than having a book that you want to come back to. I always say life is better when you're reading a good book, and it's true. When you finish a hard day's work and you go, God, I can't wait to get back into this story, that's a special day. And it's hard to find books that are always that good, very hard.
Yeah, we have a woman at work, and she sits and she reads a lot. And she's the only one there who does. And so, of course, everybody else makes fun of her. They think, oh, she just sits there and reads all the time. It's like, but it's fun for her. It's what she loves to do. She's relaxing. That's her way to relax. And I guess people don't...
Well, God bless her.
People, I haven't seen her read any of your books yet, but I'll have to ask her at some point.
You can tell her. Funny thing is,
she had the new Dan Brown on her desk the other day, so I know she was reading that. But, you know, you just... Like you said, Dan Brown. But, you know, you just never know what people are going to like. I mean, everybody...
Sure.
I mean, do you tend to have more male or female readers? Do you know what your readership is?
I don't know. I think I do skew a bit more male, which is a shame since women buy more books. And the women then read the books and go, I haven't read your books. I didn't know they were so good, or I didn't know I'd enjoy them so much. So it's funny, my new book, Invasion of Privacy, is very different setting than my other books because the hero is just a simple mother of two girls, and it's very much kind of a family thriller. Pitting this mother, this wife, widowed wife of an FBI agent against, you know, a simple mother in Austin, Texas, against the most powerful internet mogul in the world. So it's very fun, and it's a story that definitely is interesting for women. So I think this next one's really going to grab a lot of women.
Now, I don't remember where I read it, but I read somewhere that you're like the John Grisham of the money world, of the economic world.
That was a nice quote, yeah, from the New York Times said that.
I don't know where I saw it, but I know I saw it. Maybe it was in the release I got or something, but I saw it somewhere, and I thought, oh, that's a great thing to say about it. That'll get them going, and it's got to be. I mean, every book's a challenge for you. You start out, you're sitting there, and you don't even have a title. You don't even have any words written, and you're thinking, where am I going to go next?
And that's the challenge, and it is hard. And when you're not writing a series, you know, when you're coming up with brand new characters that are real and making them three dimensional, putting them into a story, that's the fun part of the book. That's the joy of writing.
What kind of letters do you get from people? I mean, what do people like about your books?
I usually get just nasty letters from gun owners. I somehow, sometimes, unfortunately, make some mistakes with my firearms descriptions, and they don't take kindly to it.
Oh, really?
I'm just joking. They are vocal, though, if I make a mistake, but they're usually quite polite about it. I get a lot of fan mail. Emails these days, people just say, you know, I love your book, when's the next one coming out, or thank you for writing this book. I do remember a couple of really nice letters I got. My second book actually was called The Runner. It was a World War II story. It took place right at the end of World War II.
Yeah.
And kind of traveled the course of Germany. And I got one really nice letter from a retired English Army general who had served in World War II and served in Europe. And it said, "Dear Mr. Reich, I had to write you." He goes, "Because as I read The Runner, it took me back so vividly to my days when I was fighting alongside the Rhine, you know, along the Rhine River." And basically the letter just said that the book was able to completely transport him back in time. And it was so accurately written and descriptions were so vivid that it made him feel like he was a young 30-year-old major again leading his troops. And that was a really great letter.
Wow. Well, see, that makes it all worthwhile. I mean, just that one person can make it all worthwhile. I mean, it doesn't even have to be.
Nice to hear, yeah.
I mean, you never know who you're going to get mail from and these days. And, you know, people don't write letters like they used to either. I mean, it's all emails and stuff. But I don't know.
For this book, for The Prince of Risk, before it came out, we sent copies to many people in the hedge fund industry, in the financial industry, many big shots, you know, people that ran companies. And I immediately got a letter back from Henry Kravis, who's one of my personal financial heroes, the head of Colbert, Kravis, and Roberts. It was the first big private equity company that made the big deal for RJR Nabisco. They made the movie Barbarians at the Gate about it and the great book by Brian Boroh and John Hillier. And he immediately wrote back saying, "Dear Chris, thank you for sending me the book. I look forward to reading it." But what a class act. I mean, right away, you know, here he is. He's a billionaire himself, you know, probably 10 times over, but he takes the time to personally write this letter and send it over to me.
We always think of the people that have a lot of money as being arrogant. I mean, and a lot of times they're not, but I mean, we see people like Donald Trump and, you know, and they think they seem to be really full of themselves, and right away
he certainly is, yeah. He certainly is, and I think this just spoke to how well-mannered and how professional Henry Kravis was. Now, you asked about letters. There's one letter that I do have that I framed, and it came out after my book Rules of Deception in 2008. In fact, the book came out, that book was, I think, pretty much my biggest bestseller. And my publisher got a call from someone in the Oval Office. They say, this is Elizabeth calling from the Oval Office, you know, or from the White House. Can we have Mr. Reich's personal address? I said, that's either something that makes you very happy or very scared.
Yeah, really.
And then, lo and behold, a week later, I got this very big envelope, and inside was handwritten on White House stationery from President George W. Bush, saying, "Dear Christopher, I just read Rules of Deception and enjoyed it. Story's fast-paced and the characters are fascinating. Keep writing, you're on a roll. Yours, George Bush."
Wow.
And handwritten, you know, in his personal in blue ink. And I'll tell you, that's about as big a thrill as you can get as a writer, is a handwritten note from the President of the United States of America. So thank you, George Bush.
Wow, that's pretty exciting. And it just makes you feel like you've done something worthwhile. And that's, as an author, I guess that's the ultimate. You feel that people are moved at all by your books. Dennis Lehane has said that what he doesn't like is apathy. He says, "I don't care if people like my books or hate my books. It's the ones that don't care either way that bother me."
Yeah, isn't that a very good point? I hope that when they're writing, at least, you know, you provoke some emotion.
I mean, you just never know. Books are not for everybody. I mean, this book is not for everybody. As much as you'd love it to be, it's not. There are people that are going to read it and think, "Well, this is not my type of book." I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying it, but I enjoy the characters. Like you said, the characters are what make the book for me. I mean, the characters have to be believable. I have to be rooting for. I mean, I love the elevator scene in this book. I won't give it away.
Don't give it away.
I love.
Funny, yeah.
I love the. And people are thinking, "Well, what could happen on an elevator?" You know, but they'll see when they read the book. But you know, it's funny how you can pick a scene out of a book out of your head and remember it, and it just sticks with you. You know.
That book starts off, you know, not slow, but starts off moving pretty fast, but then it really picks up speed toward the end. I think I defy people to really stop reading the last 200 pages because so much is in play and people are in such danger. And that's when it starts really rocketing around the world. It's really fun to see what happens. I remember writing it going, this is so fun to write. This is going to have to be fun to read, because I was really enjoying writing some of the scenes where the FBI agent Alex Forza goes to London to look into private armies, these private companies that raise, you know, that find mercenaries and set up these private armies. Another thing that's so interesting to research, you know, when I was writing, I was going, this is going to be fun to read.
So your rules book, is that series over, or will you continue that series?
I'm halfway through the fourth book, and I'm not sure if I'll publish it, if it will be published in hardback, but it will be, you know, available as an ebook. Probably within 6 months. And I still need the title. It's Rules of Something, but I'm not sure what yet.
Oh, really? So we're not going to see it in book form? It's just going to be in e-book form?
No, I'm not sure yet. I'm just actually figuring out what to do. Just because I was so inspired to write this book I'm writing now, Invasion of Privacy. That was one of the few times where the story just came to me. It's like, oh, I see this story. I got to write this story. And so I put aside my rules book to write this. And so we'll see. It's up to the publisher, you know, when we can find a good date for it.
Okay. And also, when you're not writing, when you're not reading, what else do you like to do? I mean, what would be fine you doing? Obviously, you like to exercise, you said, but I mean, what
else? I work out all the time and train. I'm training right now for a climb I'm going to do in April. I'm going to go up the Mountaineer's route of Mount Whitney. Mount Whitney, which is the highest mountain in the lower 48
really?
States at 14,800 feet. And I've gone up there before. I've walked up there. There's a walk. It's quite strenuous, but it's 11 miles up, 11 miles down. I've done that. Now I'm going to go up the front, which is the climb.
Wow.
So a little bit of snow, so I try to train for that. In fact, after this call, instead of going right to work, I'm going to put on my backpack with about this morning. I'll put like 35 pounds in and go for a two-hour hike. I live up in the hills here, so two-hour hike, come back, shower, then go to work till 6 or 7 tonight. So I love that. I play a little golf. That's about it these days.
Are you nervous about climbing the mountain?
No.
It doesn't make you nervous?
I'm nervous about just being in shape. I just want to be in good shape for it. So, you know, you got to be in really, really good condition because of the altitude.
Oh, interesting. So you really have an interesting life.
That's fun, yeah. My other thing on my bucket list is to climb the Matterhorn. I've gone 3 summers over to Zermatt, Switzerland, in shape and ready to go, and got snowed out in the middle of the summer, and just had the just picked the wrong week to go. The Matterhorn, as they say, it's the hardest mountain for an inexperienced climber to go up. It's the easiest mountain for an experienced climber, but it is a 4,000-foot straight-up face with lots of places to put your feet, but right behind you is, you know, an increasing distance, so there's a lot of exposure, they say. So I want to climb the Matterhorn.
Very cool. So you really are clearly goal-oriented. I mean, you know what you want. You know what you want from life. I mean, that's the way it sounds. That's the way you sound. What's that?
It's good to have goals. I like that. I like to put them out there and try to go after them.
Right. So you'll be finishing Invasion of Privacy very soon.
Hopefully within 3 weeks. I want to turn that sucker in and move on to the next project.
Now, does that mean we get to see it this coming December?
Yes. Well, I hope before December. I hope we can have it out by, you know, late October or so, or early October. So it'll be, get it in the pipeline, but the publishing pipeline. But hopefully, you know, by before the end of the year.
Yeah, they have their catalog. They have to show. You know,
exactly.
You have to get it in time for the catalog. You know, you can't just.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, oh, that's exciting. So there's just some exciting things coming up for you. That's great. It's been so great to talk to you, Christopher.
Well, thank you, David. Thank you for the interest, and I will be visiting your site regularly.
Yeah, thank you. And the new book is called The Prince of Risk. Once again, it's from Doubleday and all your bookstores and e-books and everything. So thank you very much. This has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.